Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable once again, and welcome to our book pick segment, our first book pick segment of calendar year 2026. And we couldn't start off better if we tried, and we actually did try. So that's why we asked Mike Hare if he could join us. Mike Hare is with Northshire Bookstore in Saratoga Springs and Manchester Center, Vermont, and joins us this morning to present some of the great books that are either here or making their way to store shelves this early in the year. But we still have a little bit of of 2025, and then all this new stuff coming out.
There was a lot in 2025, Joe, and many of the books I'll talk about today came out late in the year of 2025, and a few that are coming out in April of this year. But the first one I'd like to talk about is one of my favorites of the year. It's called The Gales of November. The author is John U. Bacon. And it is about the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. And those words will come to listeners' minds with the Gordon Lightfoot song that came out soon after the Edmund Fitzgerald went down, which was 50 years ago, November of 1975. John U. Bacon is the author, and he does a wonderful job of describing, A, the Great Lakes, the enormity of the Great Lakes. It's not a lake, it's an ocean. He mentions that right at the beginning of the page. It's not an ocean technically, but it feels like one, especially Lake Superior, where this tragedy happened, the largest of the five Great Lakes. He talks about the role of the Edmund Fitzgerald. Primarily, it was tasked with getting ore pellets from the Duluth, Minnesota area in Canada, shipping them down to the Midwest, Toledo, for the manufacture of steel eventually. They had a couple of major rules for the Edmund Fitzgerald through the years. A, to carry as much as possible, even if you exceeded the limit a little bit. That was okay because you needed to get the product there. And B, to do it as quickly as possible. You didn't want to dawdle. You had to get there as quickly as possible to make sure that things moved along the chain effectively. And the very last voyage in November of 1975 was this trip that is now immortalized and mourned and also talked about or sung about by Gordon Lightfoot. And on that particular day that they left the Duluth area, it was sunny. It was Indian summer. The weather was perfect. And before they got to Toledo, they never got there because of the huge gales of November which came. And Bacon does a magnificent job of talking about not just the tragedy, as bad as it was, but the crew, the people, the families, the friends, people that were on board the ship, who, of course, their voices were lost. But they had voices before that that he quotes. He talks about the wives, the mothers. They're all men. There are 29 men on the ship. There are no women. And he humanizes the event to such an extent, by the time you're done reading the book, you feel like you know these people. You know these. You know the situation. You know what they went through. And the Edmund Fitzgerald was the last of many, many shipwrecks on the Great Lakes. Since then, in 1975, there have been no significant wrecks. Before that, there was something like one a week. The safety precautions that are in place today were certainly not in place then. Of course, the communication was different at that time, too. Not nearly as sophisticated, but the book is just a magnificent tale of this tragic event. But again, Bacon humanized it to an extent that you just feel for these people and you just have a very good sense of what they went through.
I think I said this to you when we were when I saw you in the store recently, but and we were talking about this book, but it doesn't it seems longer ago than 50 years ago.
Doesn't it? Yeah, it does.
It really
does.
It's quite amazing. Yeah. That this is, in the grand scheme of things, recent.
Well, yeah, sure, absolutely. And Gordon Lightfoot is mentioned in the book, as you probably could tell, in a very favorable way. He was not out to make a buck on this. He was not out to try to sensationalize it. He was very moved by what happened. He was Canadian, and he was from that area. And it's very interesting how that song came about. I don't want to spoil that. Maybe some listeners know the story already, but it's just fascinating in a number of ways.
John Bacon is the author of The Gales of November. All right, next up.
Brightly Shining by Ingvild Rojboy. It's a Norwegian book. I may have mispronounced the author's name, but it is a wonderful book that came out actually last year. It's a Christmassy kind of a book, but it's also an all-season book, and it's a novella. It's told by it's first-person narrative, and the first person is an 11-year-old girl living in Oslo, Norway. She is hard-pressed. She and her sister are trying to get by. Their father is a loving man, but he's also a bit of a drunk, and he was not terribly responsible. And the 11-year-old girl had to make a decision to sell Christmas trees one Christmas season just to try to support the family. But the voice of this girl is just so authentic and wonderful. And it reminds me, in the style of the book, it's a novella. It's a very short book. And the author's style is very similar to Claire Keegan. And I think I probably talked about Claire Keegan with you before, Joe. And I'm sure other commentators have as well, because she's a worldwide talent. People, I mean, in terms of her appreciation, it's something that goes well beyond Ireland. Claire Keegan has a wonderful economy of language in what she writes. Foster, small things like these. Her work is very, very short, but it packs a huge punch. And Brightly Shining is a lot like that. The author is able to say a lot in a very, very distilled kind of a language, but it's very emotional. It's very funny, too. There's a great deal of humor. And you never for a second doubt the fact that this narrator is very authentic. It's not like some adult trying to sound like a little kid. The little kid sounds like a little kid. It's a wonderful little book.
It is called Brightly Shining, and by Ingvild Rishoy.
Rishoy, I believe.
We'll
Rishoy.
Go with that. Yes. All right. Next up.
Next up, we have a book coming out in April, and Patrick Radden Keefe is the author, and it's called London Falling. Not London Calling like the Clash song, or not like London Bridge is falling down, but London Falling. And it's set, guess what, in London. And Keefe wrote two wonderful books, Say Nothing about the Troubles of Northern Ireland, and Empire of Pain about the Sackler family and the opiate crisis. And he's a journalist who knows how to tell a story well. It reads like fiction. And London Falling is about this kid, his teenager in London, came from a fairly wealthy family, but he wanted to put on the impression that he was more wealthy than he was. And he impersonated the son of a Russian oligarch, and he got to know people that were in that milieu. It was very intoxicating to him, but it was also very dangerous. There was money, huge amounts of money involved. There were drugs, and he had to try to prove to these people that were in this social class that he was one of them. His father was, he couldn't introduce his father because his father was not a Russian oligarch or his family, but he tried to put on an act for as long as he could, and then he could not. Things happened at the end which were not very pleasant, and Keefe is able to get into this situation so very well. And the story itself is maybe 4 or 5 years old, and probably pre-COVID, right around the COVID era is when this actually happened, maybe a little bit after. So it's a contemporary story, and it's just as good, in my opinion, as both Say Nothing and Empire of Pain, as other two very, very well-written books. He's all over the board in what he writes about, Northern Ireland, and then the Sackler family in the U.S. Now here is back in England for London Falling. It comes out April 7th, I believe, and it's a heavy read. You know, it's very intense. He's a very dense kind of a writer, but in a good way, because, again, he knows how to be historically accurate, and he knows how to tell a story.
Say Nothing is one of my favorites, and I look forward to London Falling by Patrick Radden Keefe coming out in April. All right, next.
After Midnight by Daphne du Maurier, and people may know Daphne du Maurier by her most famous book, which was Rebecca, which came out in the 1930s, became a Hitchcock movie soon after, which won the Academy Award in 1940. And After Midnight is a selection of du Maurier's stories, and they are fantastic. They're just great. Stephen King wrote the intro to the book, and Stephen King adores du Maurier, and he explains why. And what du Maurier does is she writes, you think of Stephen King, you think of a certain kind of horror, but there's a psychological aspect to Stephen King, and there's definitely a huge psychological aspect to these stories. They're not graphic, they're not blood and gut stories, but from the first story on, Blue Lens is the first story, and there are 13 stories in the book in the collection of stories. And the world is just a little bit or a lot off kilter. You know, you think you're walking in a straight line, and then the sidewalk slips, and then there's a big gully, and then there's quicksand, and then there's a sinkhole, and then you're walking on level ground again. Kind of like the Twilight Zone in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
The Birds is one of the stories in this book, and I'm sure most listeners have seen or heard of The Birds, the Hitchcock movie, which was based on the Du Maurier story. The Du Maurier story is much more disturbing than the movie. You know, the movie's Hitchcock, but with his style. But the story itself is one of the 13 within the collection, and I've given this as Christmas presents to friends, and I've been very high on this collection. She's very clear. She's really an excellent writer. And always appreciate it. And you need to, when you read these stories, you need to put yourself into her milieu, which was mid-20th century, upper middle class European life. She was British. The stories are set in Britain or in European continent. But the stories themselves, even though they're set in a time that's past, do have the universal appeal to be very relatable today. And she draws you in, and these odd things happen, and you follow along, and sometimes you kind of see where it's going. Sometimes you cannot, but they're fun to read and very, very well written.
It was an amazing collection. I would not have known about it had it not been for Stephen King and reading an essay that he wrote about it. Mm-hmm. And what great work. I'm just so glad I got to read it.
Isn't it great?
Yeah, really fun stuff. Yeah.
There are 13 stories, and I would rate maybe 10 of them, anyway, different opinions. But with me, I think about 10 of those were either outstanding or borderline outstanding. I mean, they're consistently good.
Really, really good stuff.
Yeah.
The name of the book is After Midnight. Okay. Next up, big bestseller this holiday
1929
season.
Yeah. By Andrew Ross Sorkin. And as you can guess, it's about the year 1929 and the stock market crash. And the book reads, again, all these books that I've talked about. And that's the great thing about working at the North Shore Bookstore and Revolves, because these books are so well written. And so, and they capture what they're supposed to capture so well. And Sorkin captures what was going on in 1929 in the financial world very, very well. I'm not an economist. I'm not a financial guy at all. I can balance my bank statement pretty well, but I'm not really in tune to the intricacies of what's going on with finance today or then. But the book is in-depth enough to let you know what's happening, but not so in-depth that you're lost in the weeds of what's going on. So it reads extremely well. It talks about the Fed. He talks about Herbert Hoover, who was the president, of course, at the time, and Roosevelt became president after that in the Depression, which came after 1929. But he talks about some of the causes and some of the roots of the problems of 1929. And between the lines, he's not overt about this, but he talks about what happened in 2008. The big fail, which I have not read, which came out in 2010 or so, which was about the recession, the Great Recession of 2008. That was his earlier book. But anyway, he does draw some parallels. Will this happen then, and could it happen again? He doesn't go into that in any great detail, but you can kind of see that there is a underlying theme that could always be a problem, regardless of who's in power or what the situation is financially. But 1929 is one of the best-selling books of the year, I believe. The Yellows of November as well. They're both, you know, bestsellers. But 1929 is a hefty, it's a big book, but it reads very well and very quickly. It's kind of a page-turner, which surprised me, because I didn't expect a book about 1929 to be a page-turner, but at least to me it was.
I was on vacation over the holidays, and we were at a resort, and a lot of people, I don't know about you, Mike, but I can't get enough of seeing what people are reading. I'm just fascinated by this. Just want to see what they're reading. And there's all kinds of profiling that goes on. I'll admit it, but it's fascinating to see. But maybe 6-7 people reading that book around the, and I thought, that's really interesting.
And different, not just the same class of people either, Joe. These aren't financial people. These are anybody. Yeah,
it was really good, and he's a great writer. Andrew Ross Sorkin is the author of 1929. Okay, next up,
Buckeye by Patrick Ryan, and this book, Joe, is it really took off over the year. Probably 5 or 6 fellow booksellers at the bookstore have read this, and we all really kind of adore it. Patrick Ryan's been writing for some years. He's written a few other books, which I've not read. This is my first foray into him. It's a traditional novel, Buckeye is in the Buckeye State, Ohio. That is where it's set. And it's essentially about two families. And the time frame is from roughly the time of World War II until the Vietnam War. It also goes back in time before that with sort of the generations before the main characters in the book, and then afterward beyond the Vietnam War. But it focuses on two married couples to become two families and their interrelations. And there are slices of life in this book that ring very, very true, like Du Maurier talking about mid-20th century Europe with her off-kilter tales. This is mid-20th century America. This is very on-kilter. It doesn't have those sort of fantastic elements that Du Maurier has. But the characters are so well drawn. It's funny at times. It's tragic at times. It's kind of sentimental at times. It's very realistic all the way through. You believe these characters and what they're going through. There are surprises that happen through the way. It's framed by the wars because there are people that fought in World War II. And in fact, one of the characters in the book is someone who fought during World War I, and he is like a grandfather to the folks, the main characters of the book. So you're dealing with American wars and in different eras and how people react to them. That's not the main theme of the book, but it sort of holds it together. And it's been, this is another book like 1929, which is sold not just with us, but throughout the country very, very well, and for good reason. It's worth reading. It's, I would say, probably one of the three or four most popular works of fiction that we've had in the store this year. So, again, it came out, I think, right about last summer, last July, last August. So it's new. So all these books, you know, the ones except for the Keefe book so far that I've talked about, are all within the last few months and still very popular.
It was just an amazing novel. There was so much there. And I think my two favorite books, two favorite novels of 2025 was Karen Russell's The Antidote, and then also this book, and they're weirdly similar in a not so straightforward way, but just good old fashioned great storytelling.
Yeah, I remember this book was, the sales rep came in and talked about, which we're very lucky to have people from the publishing houses come into the store sometimes and let us know what's coming up in advance. And she said, well, this is a traditional book, but I think that people are going to catch in, you know, are going to appreciate it and like it. So I remember I was able to grab a copy then before it came out. And I was so glad that I did.
Yeah.
And as I said, Joe, many, I think probably about five or six of us have read it now in the store. And like you, you know, everybody is just likes it a lot. You know, it's so good.
We have a bookseller on our program who put it in my hand and said, by the time I see you next, you will have read this.
Mm-hmm. And you did.
I did. I don't say no to you all. You're much too powerful in my life. Okay, next up.
John and Paul by Ian Leslie. And you can guess who John and Paul are.
Yes.
There have been probably hundreds, thousands of books written about these two guys and the band that they were in. I don't know how many. But John and Paul was published last year. And it's about Lennon and McCartney. And it's excellent. It really is. And it's excellent because he does an excellent job, using that word too much, but it is excellent. And he talks about the relationship that they had, how they began. He can't really get into the astounding creativity of Lennon and McCartney. That's something that's kind of not easily explained by anybody. But he talks about how they worked together, how they played off each other, how they influenced each other, how they challenged each other, and about their personalities, especially Lennon, because Lennon was more perhaps of a difficult individual than McCartney in terms of his, you know, his personality and the way he could be at times somewhat abrasive. But he talks about Lennon as with a sense of loss that he had through his life. Both McCartney and Lennon lost their mothers when they were young, so they had that bonding going on. But McCartney had, despite that, he had a very stable home life. His father was a very gracious man from all accounts. He had a younger brother, so he was able to stay at home and be nurtured in a very positive environment in Liverpool, where Lennon never knew his father. If he did, it was only in passing. He was never part of the family. And when Lennon's mother died, he went to live with his aunt Julia, as in the song from the White Album. Julia was his aunt, who he was very close to. He was especially close to, which I didn't know this, present to Julia's husband and his uncle. And Lennon's uncle, he died when Lennon was fairly young, so he was sort of, that scarred him. He was married to Cynthia Powell early on when the Beatles formed, and that marriage broke up, which was another scar. So he had these wounds that he had, along with the way that his attitude was to begin with, which influenced his music and his relationships with the band. So Leslie talks in great detail about that, and he also talks in detail about McCartney's life, which was much more normal, if you will. And he was very social, McCartney. When the Beatles were popular, he was a man about town in London, going, like the song, here, there, and everywhere. He'd just be all over the place, going to parties and going to places. Lennon wasn't a recluse by any means. Later on, by the time the 70s came, he lived in the Dakota and didn't surface for a few years. But the book goes into their relationship in such a way as you can see how the songs were kind of created and how the band was moved in different directions by the creativity and by the differences. And again, about the fact that they, they respected each other, they worked together, but they were both competitive individuals and they both wanted to challenge each other. And there was a one-upsmanship going on that's been talked about in other books as well. But if you want to get into the nitty-gritty of how these two men worked together and how they were able to try to create what they did and what they did create, it's a good place to start.
I there's always these times where I think I know just about everything there is to know about the Beatles, and then something comes along, and I don't know if you got to see the I guess Disney did it, the Disney Plus, the anthology series.
Yeah, I didn't see it, but
the nine parts to that, and then that book. Mm-hmm. My goodness, and then with this, it's really fascinating.
It is.
There's still so much to learn and to find out about the dynamics of. Mm-hmm. One of the greatest of all times. Okay, we have 5 minutes.
Okay.
I think we can get a
couple more.
In.
Yep. Speaking of great artists, Vermeer, A Life Lost and Found by Andrew Graham Dixon. This book comes out in April, and it's about Vermeer, who is as elusive an artist as there ever was and as great an artist, really, as there ever was. And what this author does is try to pin him down, which is not, it's something which no one's really ever been able to do. He was active in his day. He was moderately successful, Vermeer. He had a patron that most of his paintings went into this one home, which is revealed in this book. There are about 35 paintings of his that exist. And I'm sure that most listeners are familiar with The Girl with the Pearl Earring and his work, which is so kind of magical, really. It's, in terms of, in terms of creative talent, Lennon, McCartney, and Vermeer, I mean, it's just sort of astounding what he could do with so seemingly so little. There was a woman looking out the window. There's always light coming in from the left. There's someone, a woman sewing, the milkmaid, she's pouring milk. You think, well, this isn't really what's going on here, but there's so much going on. He's able to do so much with the effect of light and the effect of color. And Vermeer had 11 kids that survived to be adults, which is just crazy.
That
I mean, he writes these, he painted these contemplative paintings, and there's an awful lot of hubbub when there are 11 kids at home, I would imagine. So it's just completely different from his real life. He was in debt at times. His friend became a baker. They grew up together, and the baker extended Vermeer credit so he could have bread to feed his family. That's how kind of hard up he was. He was dependent on his mother-in-law. His mother-in-law was rich, but not terribly generous to him. Vermeer spent a lot of time away from home, but he also, what the author does is put this in the historic context. The war with Spain ended when Vermeer was 16. It was an 80-year war between the Dutch and Spain, and then the Dutch finally gained their independence. So there was a little window of huge creativity in the Netherlands at that time, and Vermeer was a contemporary of Rembrandt. Rembrandt was a little bit older, but they were completely dissimilar in how their personalities and how they painted. But Vermeer, A Life Lost and Found, comes out in April. And one of the good things about the book is the book will have, I believe, all of the paintings and the color plates in color, which makes it worth buying just for that reason.
It is Vermeer, A Life Lost and Found by Andrew Graham Dixon. Finally, a book that comes out, I think, in 2 weeks.
Yeah, Vigil, George Saunders. You know George Saunders, Joe.
I do.
And this is about, it's sort of like a mini Lincoln in the Bardo, this book. And it's about the last night of the life of a man who was, unlike Lincoln in the Bardo, Lincoln was a commendable figure. This fellow, maybe not so much so. He was a kind of a shady businessman kind of a guy, and not terribly ethical at times, but he's in his last throes of life, and this angelic person comes to visit him, and that's her job, and she's done this 300 times, and here's my new assignment to escort this guy into the next life or whatever. So she's a character, this guy is a character, and some people from this individual's life come back, some former business associates who didn't really like him. They didn't really get along. There was some shifty dealing going on. So you have all these, but it's George Saunders. So he's like a jack-in-the-box as you're reading, and then this jack-in-the-box pops up, and it's so funny, and then it's kind of back on the ground. It's like Du Maurier, but in a funny kind of a way. And then the language of Saunders, as everybody who reads him knows, it's just great. I mean, it's phenomenal stuff.
Yeah, we did an interview with him on Friday, and I was just blown away by the book, and I'm always blown away by speaking to him. There's a great interview in the Times that they did an in-depth profile as well, which really gives you an idea of this guy. And man, it's great. Just a terrific book. I remember when his first book came out, it was released around this time, and they said, well, already the best book of this year has already been
right.
released.
Yeah.
And I feel that way with this book.
Oh, so. Yeah. No, it's great. And he seems to be too. Yeah.
Yeah. Great stuff. Mike Hare is our guest. You can find out more information by going to Northshire.com. Visit them in Manchester or in Saratoga. You can go to the website Northshire.com and see the list on our website, WAMC.org/roundtable. Mike, you're the best. Thank you.